Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of only in sci-fi technology of the early 21st century will be widely available by the beginning of the 22nd? My guest today interviewed more than 300 scientists across a wide variety of disciplines to learn where they think today's most promising research will lead in the decades to come and how all that new technology will change how we work, play, travel, and communicate. Michio Kaku is professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York and a co-founder of string field theory. His new book is called The Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Professor Kaku, welcome to Think.
Well, glad to be on, Chris.
So much of what we're going to talk about this hour sounds almost too good to come true, but you remind us that most predictions of future capabilities have actually fallen short of what's turned out to be possible.
That's right. When you look back 100 years and they were to predict the world of today, for example, people back in 1900 thought there would be blimps, dirigibles, hundreds of them that would take us across the Atlantic Ocean, not realizing that airplanes and jet planes would make it all possible. So I think that people have been really restrained by their imagination. So what I did was I interviewed, as you mentioned, 300 of the world's top scientists, because these are the people who are inventing the future in their laboratory. They're not science fiction writers. They're actually building the prototypes which are going to change everything around us.
And on the other hand, some things that we expected have not come true. And you think the limitations have more to do with our sort of biological ties to our caveman ancestors than with inability to master technology.
That's right. When you take a look at the paperless office, that was one prediction made decades ago. We realized that it flipped the other way. We have too much paper in the office now. And part of that is because our brains have not really changed much in 100,000 years since we left Africa. And as a consequence, our emotions, our mental architecture is pretty much the same, even though we have nuclear weapons, we have the internet, we have GPS, we have laser beams. But the way we interact with technology is pretty much the same. For example, we want proof of the kill. We are descended from hunters. They want proof of the kill. You just can't boast about the one that got away. So that's why we like paper. Paper gives us proof that we did something rather than trusting the electrons dancing in our computer screen, which we inherently distrust. We like to have proof of the kill. Or for that matter, if someone gives you two raggedy rock tickets to your favorite rock concert or a picture of your favorite rock star, which would you choose? Most people would take the tickets because you want to bond with the people you admire. And that's why the peopleless city never took place. Teleconferencing never took over from commuting. We still commute to cities because we still like to bond with our fellow workers.
The one exception there may be that if you have one of those GPS things, your husband will listen to the robot voice more than the person sitting next to them in the seat. I want to talk about what computers will do for us in the future. For one thing, we may no longer think of computers as discrete objects because they will be incorporated into just about everything we touch.
That's right. The internet, for example, will be in our contact lens. We already have prototypes of this. And that means that when we blink, we'll go online. And when we see people, we'll see the biography of the person right next to their image in our contact lens. And if they speak Chinese to us, the contact lens will translate Chinese into English and give us subtitles as they speak. And the first person to line up to buy these internet contact lenses will be college students taking final examinations. They will simply be able to blink and download most of the answers on their final exam. And the second people to buy these things will be artists, because they can simply wave their hand, modify any sculpture that appears in their contact lens. Or if you're an architect and you want to make changes in a building, today is very tedious and time-consuming to do that. In the future, you just wave your hands, and you'll be able to move and distort and change the blueprint of what you are designing. And if you're a tourist, you'll be able to recreate the entire Roman Empire in your contact lens as you walk through the ruins of Rome.
So going back to the example of college students, you know, on their final exams, the idea that they would be cheating this way is very distressing, but I'm wondering if it's so easily available at all times, will we need to memorize things in the future?
That's right. When you look back at a textbook of 1900, scientists then had to memorize crystals. They had to memorize lots of facts and figures that are totally irrelevant. And today we just look it up on the Internet. So my attitude as a professor is that we want to stress concepts and principles rather than memorizing the names of the crystals, memorizing the names of the minerals, because you're going to look them up anyway. We want to test whether or not you understand the concepts that drive biology, that drive physics, and drive chemistry. So these Internet contact lenses will change the way that we view education.
Right now we worry so much about, kids sitting at the table and texting their friends or one another mm-hmm. instead of talking face-to-face. I think about if you have something incorporated in your eyes, you could be staring right at someone and ignoring them. Do you worry about that?
No, because take a look at the movie The Matrix mm-hmm. or the holodeck in Star Trek. Kids would love that stuff, and they're going to be bonding with people from around the world. You realize that kids today maybe play with somebody in Russia, somebody in Switzerland, somebody in Australia for their video games
yeah.
without even thinking twice. They know more about somebody in Russia than their next-door neighbor. And so I think that's going to break down some barriers that we have between nations. And, of course, it's democratic when you can simply visualize or talk to anybody you want in your contact lens. Look at what's happening to the Middle East, and that's just Facebook penetrating the Middle East. Look what's happened there. And remember that no two democracies ever war with each other. Think of all the wars that you learned about ever since you were in grade school. They've always been between dictatorships and monarchies, but never between two democracies. So as the Internet spreads, as people bond with people from different cultures from around the world, we will still have wars, of course, but the fires of war will be lessened because we'll know who these people are, we'll have democratic governments, and democracies never work with each other. And I think that's a good thing.
What would it take for us to be able to read the mind of another human being?
Well, it's happening much sooner than you think. Already, we can put a cap on somebody's head that picks up radio emissions from what they're thinking, and then take a computer to decipher that and use that computer to play video games and surf the web. So we can now take stroke victims who are totally paralyzed, who are almost like vegetables, hook them up to a laptop computer directly to the brain, and these people can now surf the web and answer emails and write emails and do crossword puzzles, and they're totally paralyzed. So I think that by perhaps mid-century, we will probably telepathically control robots and telepathically control objects around us. Just like magicians, or in fact, for that matter, just like the gods of mythology, Zeus, the god of mythology, used to simply think, and things would happen around them. So I think that when we look at our grandkids and our great-grandkids of the year 2100, we'll look at them as the gods of mythology, in the same way that our ancestors of 1900, who were dirt farmers, would view us today as magicians and sorcerers.
And one of the first things we'll need to be able to do as we start to study these patterns of radio signals emitted by the brain is create what's called a dictionary of thought. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, that's coming very fast. You realize that if you were to look at dogs, cats, trees, and things like that, we can put this cap on your head, and the cap would identify the fact that you're looking at a dog or a cat or a tree. And in fact, in Japan, there's even a plan there to photograph a dream. This is something right out of the movie Inception with
yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio. When you look at an object visually, a certain part of your brain lights up. And when you dream about that object, that part of your brain also lights up. So if you were to look at a pixel of light, a dot of light, then that corresponds to a certain pattern in your brain. If you move that pixel so that it then makes all possible positions of the pixel, you can now create all possible brain patterns of any possible pixel that you see. So if you see a square, for example, a square consists of many pixels, you can actually identify that pattern using a computer in the brain. So the people in Japan in Kyoto have actually been able to show that when you look at geometric patterns, stars, squares, circles, we can identify that in the brain by looking at the brain pattern.
So can we... Go ahead.
Yeah, in Japan also, by the way, they've been able to hook up the brain to a robot, Asimo the robot, and so the person simply thinks, and then the robot starts to move its arms and starts to move its legs. Now, unfortunately, this robot is not ready to be used in Japan against that nuclear accident. So far, we use bug-like robots to take pictures. But in the future, with major accidents, we'll be able to have the human brain directly control a walking robot, and the walking robot could then make repairs, handle hammers and saws, and do things that are useful inside a gigantic nuclear accident. That's coming, but it's not here yet.
So it sounds a lot like the movie Avatar in that case.
Yeah, in fact, in the movie Surrogates with Bruce Willis actually mentally controls a carbon copy of himself who is younger, more handsome, stronger. And eventually people prefer to live their life as a surrogate who is immortal and beautiful and strong rather than as themselves because they decay, they get old and decrepit. So the movie Surrogates may actually be a possibility, actually controlling a robot that has a perfect body.
So I could have my 25-year-old body and my 40-year-old brain?
Well, that's the thesis of the movie. And at the end of the movie, people have to make a decision whether or not they want to live out their life with a perfect body, a perfect mechanical body, or be stuck with the body that's aging right before their eyes.
How will we define old age in 2100?
That's going to be very interesting because we're teasing apart the genes that control the aging process now. For example, we are 98.5% identical to a chimpanzee. Only a handful of genes separate us from a chimpanzee, yet we live twice as long. Now think about this. Among a handful of genes, which scientists can easily identify, among them are the genes which have doubled our lifespan. This means that we can now isolate the genes that are involved in the aging process. Now, in the future, all of us will have a CD-ROM with our genes on it. It'll cost about $100. And we can scan the genes of old people by the millions at that point, scan the genes of young people by the millions, and subtract. We've already done this with a handful of people. And this is one way to isolate where aging takes place in the body. So we've already isolated 60 genes, just on the basis of analyzing a few hundred people, 60 genes that are involved in the aging process. In the future, we'll have millions of genomes available, and we'll be able to precisely tackle exactly where aging takes place. For example, think of a car. Where does aging take place in a car? Well, the engine. That's where you have moving parts. That's where it heats up. That's where you have carbon deposits and oxidation. Well, where is the engine of a cell? The mitochondria. So not only do we know some of the genes that control the aging process, we even know where it takes place. It takes place in the mitochondria of the gene, and that's where cell repair mechanisms also exist. So by accentuating cell repair mechanisms, we may be able to restore the youth of a cell. This means that maybe our grandkids may live to be 30, and then they may decide to simply stop aging at 30 and spend the rest of their life at age 30. That is well within the possibility that are now being explored by scientists.
My guest this hour is Michio Kaku. He is co-founder of string field theory and professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York. His new book is called The Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Michio Kaku. He is co-founder of string field theory and professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York. His newest book is called The Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. So, Professor, I'm curious about this. You say that by about the year 2030, which is not so very far away, we will sort of hit the wall in terms of how much information we can get into a certain amount of silicon. What happens then?
Yes, some people think that computer power is racing ahead so fast, doubling every 18 months, that very quickly we'll have robots much smarter than us. They'll put us in zoos, and they'll throw peanuts at us and make us dance behind bars. Well, there's a problem. And that is that in 10 or so years, Moore's Law, which simply says the computer power doubles every 18 months, will start to slow down and perhaps collapse, meaning that Silicon Valley could become a rust belt by 2020. Now, the reason for this is that transistors are getting smaller and smaller. Already you can put several hundred million in an area the size of your fingernail. This means that more heat is generated, so eventually the transistor melts. And more important, you don't know where the electrons are anymore because they're the size of molecules. The components are the size of molecules, and therefore you get leakage. Short circuits take place. So we physicists are desperately trying to find a replacement for silicon. We're looking at exotic things like atomic computers, molecular computers, quantum computers. But so far, there is no reliable replacement for silicon power. So today, at Christmas, you expect that your computers are twice as powerful as last Christmas. In fact, that's why you upgrade. That's why you buy the latest video games, knowing that they're better than last year's model. But what happens when this year's model is the same as last year's model in terms of processing power? Then you may not want to upgrade. You may not want to buy the next product, in which case we could have a recession or maybe even a depression, given the fact that computer power is not racing forward fast enough. So that's the bad news. The bad news is that we could have unemployment. We could have a slowdown in the computer age. But the good news is that we're not going to have robots replacing us anytime soon, that robot power will start to slow down in about 10 years' time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phones to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I'm going to ask what I think is a difficult question. I don't know. How will our politics influence our human technological destiny? Let's face it, Republicans will make very different choices than Democrats, and the two sides will employ and deploy such technologies very different from each other.
Well, I look at it this way. 90% of political discussions revolve around cutting the pie finer and finer. If somebody gets this amount of pie, then somebody else gets that much less pie. But I'm a scientist, and my attitude is that we should create a bigger pie. So instead of simply arguing over the allocation of resources, why not create entire new industries that could create tremendous prosperity for everyone? And that means, of course, being able to fund projects that have tremendous potential to change everything around us. And so that's my attitude. Instead of cutting things, we should realize that if you cut science, you're basically, you know, eating your seed corn, and you're not investing in the future. Now, the Chinese know this. That's why the Chinese are sending their best scientists to the United States, where I see them. And they're taking a lot of this high-tech back to China. And so my attitude is, why don't we fund science in this country to create new industries? However, when you look at the political debate, no one talks about this. Everyone talks about it as if it was a zero-sum game. You lose, I win, basically. My attitude is, why can't we have everyone win?
Now, everything we've been talking about so far today will require energy. What kinds of progress do you think we're going to make in terms of getting rid of fossil fuels and moving to something that is sustainable for the long term?
Well, let's be real about this. Solar, hydrogen, renewable, and wind power is about twice as expensive as fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Fossil fuels like oil and coal are in some sense concentrated sunlight, sunlight since the time of the dinosaurs. That's why it's very efficient. However, the cost of solar, hydrogen, and renewable wind power is going down every year, while the cost of fossil fuels, on average, is going up. And in about 10 years' time, the two curves will cross. So this means that in about 10 years' time, right now we have chaos in the energy market, right, with no white knight to replace oil and coal. Mm-hmm. But we may have a white knight in about 10 years' time, in which case solar, hydrogen, wind power become cost competitive. The marketplace takes over. For example, in Europe, a lot of European investors are now buying up the rights for the Sahara Desert. They foresee a time when huge parts of the Sahara Desert will be covered with solar cells, but it's too expensive right now. But they're buying the rights, knowing that in 10 years' time or so, costs will go down to the point where it does become economical to put solar panels over most of the Sahara Desert. And then over a 20-year time frame, by 2030, another possibility opens up, and that is fusion power. Fusion power, unlike what we see happening in Japan, creates almost no nuclear waste and basically uses seawater, not uranium, as the basic fuel. And the French and the United States and Russia and Japan are backing the ITER fusion reactor based in southern France. So if fusion pans out on a scale now of 20 years, we could be entering the solar fusion era. Now, this is good for global warming, because global warming is generated by all this carbon dioxide that's being put into the atmosphere. But if what I say is correct, it means that the danger period is not forever. The danger period is only in the next few decades, because within one decade, solar hydrogen becomes competitive with fossil fuels, and in two decades, we have the possibility of fusion power, both of which are inexhaustible, both of which are can sustain us basically forever.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Jim in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Oh, thank you, dear. Yes, I'm glad to talk to the professor. He is one of my favorite authors. I'd like to know two things. First of all, where would we be right now if we hadn't conceived of quantum physics? And the other thing is, discover the Higgs boson, how does that affect string theory? Thank you very much.
Very good questions. First of all, if quantum physics were never discovered, we would not have the electronics revolution of today. For example, take a look at the laser beam. A simple laser beam defies common sense. Common sense says that lasers should not exist, but there they are, right? And the reason why they're there is because of the quantum theory, which does defy common sense. So without the quantum theory, we would not have the laser, or the transistor for that matter, or modern electronics, the GPS system, the internet, radio, television, transistors, all of that requires the quantum theory. So if the quantum theory were not discovered around 1925, we would be very much stunted in our ability to process information and to illuminate our lives with radio, television, and the internet. And also the Higgs boson, let me say that we have an accelerator called the Large Hadron Collider, and we hope to find a missing particle in what is called a standard model. The missing particle is called the Higgs boson. There is some concern that the Large Hadron Collider may not be powerful enough to find the Higgs boson. That's why Ronald Reagan wanted to put an even bigger machine outside Dallas, Texas. It was to be built in Waxahachie, Texas, outside Dallas. It was to be called the Super Collider. And the Super Collider was to be much bigger than the Large Hadron Collider, now in Geneva, Switzerland, which is a pea shooter by contrast. Unfortunately, Congress canceled the Super Collider in 1993. The United States Congress gave us $1 billion to dig up a gigantic hole for the Super Collider. They canceled the Super Collider and then gave us a second $1 billion to fill up the hole. $2 billion to dig up a hole and fill it up.
Your tax dollars at work.
Yeah, that's the IQ of the United States Congress.
We have an email here from Laura Lisa, who says, what do you think the future of exercise holds for us? Will people have to spend their time in the gym for the bodies they desire, or will there be alternative, easier ways?
Well, we always look for alternative, easier ways, but so far we find none to exercise. none to replace exercise, because our bodies are essentially the bodies of our cavemen and cavewomen ancestors. Mm-hmm. So even though we're surrounded by all this high-tech wizardry, we still have the cavemen and cavewomen yearnings of the past. That's why we like sugar so much, even though sugar is not good for us. That's why we like animal fat. Animal fat is tasteless, you know. It doesn't taste like anything at all. But we desire something that has no taste, animal fat, because animal fat has lots of calories and it's concentrated. And in the forest, we used to prize animal fat. It was very rare and chock full of energy. And so that's why our bodies still have the yearnings for sugar, animal fat, even though these yearnings aren't good for us. So I think we have to go back in some sense to our cavemen and cavewomen ancestors' diet and lifestyle. They exercised a lot more than we did back in those days. They had a lean diet, lots of fruits and vegetables. And that's why I advocate what is called the caveman diet, which is the diet of our ancestors, because our bodies are fine-tuned, very much fine-tuned to live on that diet, which means we should exercise a lot more than we do now.
Then again, do you think, Professor, that in the future we'll have more time to spend in the gym because we have machines to take over a lot of the day-to-day life functions that we're doing for ourselves right now?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a lot more leisure time simply because the drudgery of day-to-day work will be done by machines. And in fact, in my book, Physics of the Future, I even lay out what the job market is going to look like and what the nature of capitalism itself is going to be like in the years ahead, as told to me by the economists who really think about jobs of the next 100 years. For example, the economy is making the transition from commodity-based capital to intellectual capital. For example, Tony Blair used to boast that England derives more revenue from rock music, from rock and roll, than it does the coal mining industry.
Hmm.
The coal mining industry represents commodity capital, while rock and roll represents intellectual capital. And commodities get cheaper every year. This morning, you had breakfast that the King of England could not have had 100 years ago. That's how cheap food is right now. And so nations that just invest in agriculture and food will see the wealth of their nation gradually turn to dust in the future, while nations which have a balance between commodities and intellectual capital will see their economies flourish. And by intellectual capital, I mean not just software and computers and science, but also music, movies, writing novels, anything that is creative, that involves innovation. Science and art are both included in that. That's intellectual capital, and that's going to be the currency of the future because you cannot mass-produce the brain. You can mass-produce most food stuff, containerize them better, ship them better, have more competition. That drives down the cost of agricultural products. But on the other hand, intellectual capital, like what's produced by the brain, cannot be mass-produced. You cannot mass-produce the brain. And so that's one reason why the economy of the world will gradually change as well.
Will it be socially acceptable for us to artificially enhance our brains?
Well, that's not possible today. However, in mice, we have that possibility. Scientists a few years ago discovered the smart mouse gene. It's a gene that allows certain breeds of mice to navigate mazes much better. They have better memories. When faced with problems, they solve the problems much quicker. And we have a counterpart of that smart mouse gene in our bodies. So in the future, it may be possible to enhance our brain, but at the present time, we can't do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest this hour is Michio Kaku. His new book is called The Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. We'll go next on the phone to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This whole conversation sounds like a premise in Matrix and Blade Runner and Dark City. Now, in order to understand these sci-fi films, we usually rely on continental philosophy and modern, postmodern philosophy. What would be the future of the philosophy 30 years, 40 years, 100 years from now in relation to all these innovations?
Hmm. What do you think, Professor?
Well, gee, that's a tough one, right? well, the philosophy of science is that the world is knowable, that if we concentrate our thoughts, we'll be able to understand the basic laws of nature. And so that's the philosophy of science that's held sway in our world for quite a few centuries. And I think that's going to propel us into the future. Now, however, there are some philosophies which say that God is above nature and natural law is a constraint on God. And therefore, since God can break natural law, there's no reason to study natural law. We should study religious texts instead. And believe it or not, there is a strain within certain Muslim fundamentalists, especially 1,000 years ago, which claim that natural law is a constraint, an unnecessary constraint on God. Therefore, it's not necessary to study natural law. This held sway about 1,000 years ago in the Muslim Empire. And as a consequence, even though the Muslim Empire pioneered science and physics, after all, algebra comes from the Arabic word. Algol, Altair are all names of stars that were coined by the Arabs. Even though they pioneered optics, they pioneered physics, they pioneered mechanics, 1,000 years ago they began to turn inward. And that's the danger. The danger is that we turn inward and see religious texts as being the source of truth rather than natural law as the source of truth.
My guest this hour is co-founder of String Field Theory and professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York, Michio Kaku. His new book is called The Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michio Kaku. He is professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York and author of the new book, The Physics of the Future: How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. I want to talk for a minute about medical advances, because when you look at something like cancer, not only do you say that in the future we will look at today's chemotherapy as sort of frighteningly primitive, we might in fact detect problematic cell growth long before, years before it could ever even start to cause a problem for us.
That's right. The cure for cancer may be your toilet, believe it or not, which will have something called DNA chips in it, which will analyze your bodily fluids for proteins emitted from 100 cancer cells in a colony, perhaps 10 to 20 years before a tumor forms. So this is big. It means that when you find a lump in your breast, for example, you have 10 billion cancer cells growing in your breast, so surgery is required immediately. However, because your toilet will be intelligent in the future, the word tumor could literally disappear from the English language. Your toilet will tell you that not only will you one day have 10 billion cancer cells in your body if you don't do anything, it'll tell you exactly where the cancer cells are located, and perhaps there's only a few hundred of them. Now, this could be big, because think of the people who've died of pancreatic cancer. Patrick Swayze of Dirty Dancing died of pancreatic cancer. Steve Jobs, founder of Apple Computer, has pancreatic cancer. Aretha Franklin, the famous musician, also has pancreatic cancer. And we used to think that it kills you very aggressively in 2 years. Every medical textbook says that pancreatic cancer is very aggressive and nasty. But we actually sequenced the genes recently, and it was announced a few months ago that pancreatic cancer is not that at all. It's actually a slow-growing cancer. It takes 20 years for pancreatic cancer to kill you. So you only feel the tumor in the last 2 years, but for 18 years it's been growing in your body, and you could stop it, but you're not aware of it. Hmm. That's where the smart toilet comes in. We'll be able to process the body fluids of your body and tell you that you have pancreatic cancer 20 years before you feel it. So this is going to change everything. These are called DNA chips. They already exist. Mass General Hospital in Boston, in fact, wants to market these things in 3 years. Their chip is so accurate, it can detect one cancer cell out of a billion ordinary cells. So this is going to revolutionize the way we view cancer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Plano, and we'll speak with Krishna. Hi, Krishna.
Yes, I have a question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think will be the future for aircraft engines, let's say 30 years or 40 years from now?
Well, that's a tough one because of the fact that I think we pretty much maxed out the different kinds of efficiencies that we can extract from airplane engines. Some people are thinking about maybe alternative sources of energy, like even the electric engine for airplanes. But I think we're pretty much close to the maximum of what we can derive from that. I think in terms of transport, where we haven't maxed things out is in cars and trains. We'll have super magnets of the future so that cars and trains will ride on magnetism. Right now, it's very expensive to do that. But in the future, we should have what are called room temperature superconductors to create supermagnets at room temperature without the expensive cooling system that's required today. In that case, we could have like the hoverboard of Back to the Future. Every kid knows that hoverboards allow you to hover right over the pavement. Flying cars, flying trains. These are possibilities, perhaps late in the 21st century, because of the fact that supermagnets may reduce friction. And if you think about it, most of the energy of transport goes to overcoming friction. Why do you put so much gasoline in your car? To overcome the friction of the road. But space probes can go all the way out to Pluto with hardly any fuel at all. That's because they coast in outer space where there is no friction. Just like being on an ice skating rink, it doesn't take any energy for an ice puck to go scurrying across a skating rink. In the future, we'll probably ride on magnetism, and that could eliminate the energy crisis because we're not going to have that much road friction anymore.
And we might not have to drive ourselves.
That's right. Within 8 years' time, Google Corporation wants to introduce the driverless car. We already know that it's possible. The military has perfected them, in fact. They use GPS to locate the position of your car to within about 6 to 9 inches. And it has radar in the fender to look out for hazards or car accidents. And in the future, you'll simply talk to your car, and the car will drive you where you want to go, much safer than a human because, of course, humans get drunk, humans fall asleep, humans get distracted, robots don't. So expect that in about 8 years' time, the first driverless cars will hit the market.
Hmm. What do you think it'll take for people to trust them?
Well, at first, people may not trust them. They'll get a little bit skittish. However, for long-distance travel, when you have to go miles and miles across very monotonous terrain, you may want the option of just turning it on. So you'll get used to the fact that for long-distance travel, you can turn this thing on. I think people are a little bit nervous about city traffic. It turns out that we've already tested the driverless car in city traffic, where it's perfectly fine. But some people may feel nervous about it. It'll take time. But I think when people realize the advantage of being able to sit back, relax, do homework, work on your email while the car drives itself, I think when people realize the advantage of that, then there'll be a tremendous market for it.
Well, I guess considering that a lot of people are trying to do those things now anyway when they are driving, we're probably better off with a machine taking over for us.
That's right. We text while we're driving anyway, right? So why not do it safely?
Let's go back to the phones now, 800-933-5372. We have Christopher waiting on the line in Irving. Hi, Christopher.
Hi, how you doing? The point he just made brought up a question I wanted to ask. With friction being a problem, we have a lot of engines that engines are always noisy, and I was wondering if we ever get to the point where engines are not noisy and maybe biological versus mechanical. And the other question I was going to ask is, I was going to ask if we ever manufacture, if we get it smarter, what are the chances that we'll create something that is like a slave or something in the ethics in that to do our work for us? And I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, well, a lot of the noise that you hear from an engine is because the pistons move up and down and you have crankshafts and a lot of mechanical parts. That's why the electric car is very quiet. I had a chance to drive the Tesla, which is fully electric, and you just hit the gas pedal and whoom, there you go, but there's no sound. It's eerie, in fact. You feel like you're in a science fiction movie because the car has no sound or very little sound because you don't have the sound of the pistons going up and down. You don't have the room of the traditional gas engine. But that's coming. We're going to have gasoline-fired cars very soon. People already have the hybrids, but the fully electric car is also beginning to hit the roads. So I think we can enjoy that relatively soon. Now, what was the second question you asked?
About whether or not we could create some sort of technology to have, I guess, sort of a robot slave that's artificially intelligent enough that it would perceive things in a way that is similar to human beings.
Emotional robots are next on the agenda. We now begin to realize that first we need to have emotional robots in order to bond with our robots. Otherwise, we treat them as junk. Once we think of them as a pet, then we begin to be affectionate toward the robot and we'll take care of it. And we also begin to realize that emotions are very important because to understand what is important and what is not important, to understand what is beautiful and not beautiful or precious and not precious, these are value judgments that robots do not understand. They are emotional judgments that are very important. For example, people who do brain research found that certain people who have brain damage, for example, the frontal cortex, which is the logical part of the brain, is disconnected from the amygdala, which is the emotional part of the brain. These people have a hard time processing emotions because the two are disconnected. And in fact, they're paralyzed when they have to make a simple decision about values, when to schedule the next appointment, for example. Every day is the same as every other day. They're paralyzed. Shopping is impossible for them because everything is the same to them. What's pretty, what's not pretty, useful, not useful, everything's the same to them. So we now begin to realize that robots are going to have to be programmed with emotions. Otherwise, they're not going to know what's important or not. So when I watch science fiction movies or like watch Star Trek, Spock is supposed to be totally unemotional, but he's already made hundreds of value judgments. He's already decided to join Starfleet. He's decided to become an officer. He's decided that following humans is very important. All these are value judgments. And so in the future, we're going to have to program robots to have values, or else they will be totally paralyzed making any decision requiring values.
So will we be able to program them, though, to be sort of more pleasant than, you know, the next-door neighbor that we don't get along with?
I think that's going to be relatively easy. The hard part of robotics, believe it or not, is what is called the common sense problem. We know that water is wet, not dry. We know that mothers are older than their daughters. We know that strings can pull, strings cannot push. We also know that sticks can push, sticks cannot pull. But how do we know that? I mean, how do we know that animals do not like pain? How do you know that when you die, you don't come back the next day? Well, that's common sense, right? But robots don't have common sense. That's why we can't joke with them. We can't talk to them because they have no understanding of the simple rules of logic of our world. So some scientists have tried to program all the lines of common sense, but there are hundreds and millions of these lines. And so far, no one has been able to program all the simple rules of common sense, which a five-year-old child understands. And that's one of the main stumbling blocks to robotics right now, robots that have common sense.
When you talk to all these different scientists and you look at your own work and what you have learned over the years, what are the things that everybody sort of worries about? And what are the things that maybe the average person who doesn't have a scientific background is worrying about needlessly?
Well, I think the average person needlessly watches science fiction movies and thinks, therefore, that the robots are going to take over very, very soon,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to be faced with all sorts of dangerous things, you know, because we watch so many movies. Now, in Japan, they have a different attitude toward robots. In Japan, there's a Shinto religion, which believes that there's a spirit in everything, mm-hmm. even inanimate objects. So robots have spirits inside. And that's why children in Japan have no problems relating to robots. They love robots in Japan. Well, in America, kids remember the Terminator robot, and they're afraid of robots as a consequence. But in Japan, they're not afraid of robots at all because they feel that they're kindred spirits. In fact, 30% of all commercial robots are in Japan. If you ever visited Japan, you know that robots are beginning to already enter the fabric of daily life there. Of course, they're not that intelligent. They look intelligent, but they're not that intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that they can do, you know, a very simple task. Like, for example, cook. In Japan, they've actually made a robot cook that can cook noodles in 1 minute and 40 seconds, much faster than a human, and, you know, cook basic dishes.
I could use one of those around my house.
Right.
Is there anything that you know? Let's look out to 2100. Is there anything you really specifically wish that you could be around to witness for yourself?
Yes, and that is the birth of what we physicists call a Type 1 civilization.
Mm-hmm.
A Type 1 civilization is truly planetary. They have a planetary telephone system, the internet. They have a planetary economy like NAFTA and the European Union. They have a planetary culture, rock and roll and blue jeans and youth culture. So I'm probably not going to be alive to see it, but this is going to be one of the greatest transitions in the history of the human race. Right now, we are a Type Zero civilization. We get our energy from dead plants, oil and coal. But in about 100 years' time, we will make the transition to a planetary civilization. And every time I open the newspaper, I see headlines which speak to the beginning of a Type 1 civilization. The turmoil in the Middle East, for example, that was created by the Internet, that's definitely part and parcel of the march toward a Type 1 civilization.
I'm so sorry. I have to jump in and stop you here because we're out of time. Michio Kaku is professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York and a co-founder of String Field Theory. His new book is The Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Professor, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.